This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymft. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book The Myth of Human Supremacy to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related. How can 3 weeks have slipped by with no Sequitur podcast? What happened is that I took off in two different directions and found myself with more diverse material than I could integrate under a single topic, and too much sheer volume of material than I could justify cramming into one podcast. So this one is archived as Freedom from Hope, featuring an interview with Deb Ozarko by Peter Melton that should have been ready last weekend, so I'm post-dating it for 9 December. Maybe the other one with the update on Standing Rock will follow in a few days, and I'll post-date that one for 16 December. In any case, I'll announce them on the Sequitur Podcast Facebook page, as usual. I encountered Deb Ozarko through following Guy McPherson. Deb interviewed Guy in mid-September and accepting only the livestream recordings that have emerged from his recent New Zealand tour, that interview is the best I've heard from Guy. It was in conversation with Deb Ozarko that I heard Guy define hope as attachment to an outcome over which we have no control.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's your old pal, Benjamin the Donkey. I'm trying to remove hopium from my life, but that doesn't mean I still don't have some hopes left. For example, I'm into this doomer thing deep. But there still are some hopes that I keep. Like before we all fry, I hope that I'll die quietly while I'm asleep. Turns out this doom thing eventually becomes personal for all of us. For me, facing doom has also meant facing myself, who I am, and who I was during my life. Because we're now reaching the end, there's less of a need to pretend. But the new doomer view showed myself to me too, and it's something I don't recommend. Hee-haw!
Yeah, that's the hard part. Facing the shadow. Finding myself in the other when the other is someone whose views are not aligned with my own. It is so not a single-issue world. Stick around, Benji. I value your perspective. Guy and Deb also discussed an essay Deb had written recently, which I then proceeded to download and study, and I knew I'd have to have this person on Sequitur. The title of the essay is Letting Go of a World in Collapse, The Conversation We're Too Afraid to Have. So I sent it to Peter and asked him to interview her about letting go of hope and finding freedom and empowerment. I've been wanting to interview her, he exclaimed, and got right on it as soon as his Oktoberfest commitments left some space in his agenda for Sequitur. And then there were some technical difficulties that resulted in the interview not being recorded, so he had to do it over. and then I had to spend countless editing hours on it due to ambient traffic noise, the worst of which came at such an appropriate moment in the conversation that I couldn't resist leaving it in. Meanwhile, in mid-October, John Compost Cossum interviewed Josh Fox of Gasland fame for Extinction Radio about the makings of his newest film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, which ridiculously long title I prefer to shorten to Let Go and Love, which also happens to be the text on the promotional t-shirts. Despite Josh's insistence on hitching his hopes to techno fixes that are far from agreed upon, or feasible, or likely to be effective, the documentary is beautifully filmed, and the around-the-world look at humanity's predicament and the ways in which others, especially less industrialized cultures, are attempting to adapt is quite remarkable. Indigenous wisdom seems to concur in the conclusion that fighting climate change is an exercise in futility at best and only makes matters worse in most cases, that the only things worth fighting are the forces that exacerbate, accelerate, or intensify the suffering of the life forms that call this lovely blue, green, and brown planet home. Or, as the tagline on the Guy McPherson 2016 New Zealand Tour t-shirt proclaims, "At the edge of extinction, only love remains." So I wanted John Compost Cossum to have a part in this Sequitur show. So before we hear Peter's interview with Deb, I have a reading by John of one of my favorite poems.
Thank you, Susan. It's nice to be back on Sequitur. This is John Cossum, and Susan's invited me to read out a poem that I found whilst I was exploring the subject of hope and hopium recently. It's called The Dakini Speaks, and it's by Jennifer Wellwood. So here goes. My friends, let's grow up. Let's stop pretending we don't know the deal here. Or, if we truly haven't noticed, let's wake up and notice. Look, everything that can be lost will be lost. It's simple. How could we have missed it for so long? Let's grieve our losses fully, like ripe human beings. But please, let's not be so shocked by them. Let's not act so betrayed, as though life had broken her secret promise to us. Impermanence is life's only promise to us, and she keeps it with ruthless impeccability. To a child, she seems cruel, but she is only wild, and her compassion exquisitely precise. Brilliantly penetrating, luminous with truth, she strips away the unreal to show us the real. This is the true ride. Let's give ourselves to it. Let's stop making deals for a safe passage. There isn't one anyway, and the cost is too high. We are not children anymore. The true human adult gives everything for what cannot be lost. Let's dance the wild dance of no hope.
Thank you, John Compost Cossum. That poem has been with me since I heard it at a nonviolent communication residential training retreat in 2005. Is there anything you'd like to add, Benji?
Hee-haw! A lot of people are unhappy with our current social arrangement. Mostly the disadvantaged, the oppressed, working stiffs, people like that. What they're not accepting is that social mammals form hierarchies, which are, of course, intrinsically unfair. It's not going to change, and if a certain person isn't near the top, well, basically, that's tough shit. Doom and social disruption. The poor, who are barely maintaining, will notice their hope for change waning when they're more aware that their unfair share won't improve in the time that's remaining. But you know, I've come up with a solution which nobody ever thought of before. How to Fix the Social Hierarchy Problem. Social hierarchy's a flop. It's the cause of evil nonstop. Still, things would work fine if we kept the design, but put me up at the top. When I was a kid, we used to think there was such a thing as justice in the world. The karma this time. Doom will give haters who lurk an excuse to go wholly berserk. But here's balm for despair in a world that's unfair. This time the karma will work. If none of these approaches work for you, you can always just get pissed off. Anger problem. Those shitheads, they're so full of poo. I hate everything that they do. But they'll soon crap their genes, because extinction now means those fuckers are going to die too. Hee-haw!
Thank you, Benji, for the reminder that societal dysfunction is just as important a driver of extinction as habitat collapse. It sounds like a lose-lose proposition to me. And now, here's Peter Melton interviewing Deb Ozarko.
Hello, listeners out there in Sequitur Radio Land. It is Peter Melton, today bringing you a conversation, or more, bringing you into a conversation with me and a new friend of mine, Deb Ozarko. Deb, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Very, very happy to be able to chat with you today.
Yes, and welcome to you, listeners. We're just feeling like you're sitting next to us here on the digital porch, if you will, to chat about what it's like to be alive these days and all the things that run through a person's mind and heart and soul in these ever so interesting times. You've probably heard of Deb, but just in case you haven't, I heard or read a blog that she did earlier this year that just grabbed me, and I had to reach out to her immediately saying, wow, you're saying what I'm feeling, and you're sparking a new way of seeing things. Tell us a little bit about your journey and who you are and how you find yourself right now.
Wow, that's a big question to start with. But I like big questions. I mean, that's the way I usually start on my podcast too. So I guess I have always had a passionate love for this earth. And in having a passionate love for the earth, I have a passionate love for life. And I've had a profound resonance with animals and with the natural world. And so when I started to see the reality of how animals in the natural world were viewed in my younger days, I knew that there was something wrong. And it was a natural path for me to follow the path of activism. So because everything that I knew in my life, or everything that I could see in my life, was being desecrated and violated, and I knew that inherently that was wrong, I became an animal activist, I became an environmentalist, and then, you know, as soon as you start going down the rabbit hole of truth, then so much more injustice is exposed in life. And so, you know, I became a social justice activist. I just realized the injustices on this planet were unending. Like, there's just no limits to human cruelty. And so with that awareness at a young age, it led my life in a direction that was definitely different from the status quo. You know, the status quo is all about consumption and compliance and conformity and judgment and fear and indifference. And my life was everything but. So it was a lonely path for a lot of my life until I started to find my people in the activist realm. What was wonderful at the time was I had an outlet for my rage and my grief and my despair. But what I didn't realize at the time in my early activist days was how I was actually creating more division with that form of activism, because really all I was doing was venting. I couldn't understand why people couldn't get it. And now I see clearly why, is because I was trapped in my negative emotional state. And I was just trapped in that. And that is what I was projecting. It wasn't until, I guess it was 2009, I started to look at things differently. And in 2010, I lost my mother in a very unpleasant way. It was such a shock to my system that I knew that I needed to explore more of who I am. So that led me on a path, a spiritual path, an internal journey that helped me realize that I'm so much more than who I thought I was as an activist. And it made me realize that there's so much more to life than just our physical existence. And it shifted my activism. And now I consider myself more of a spiritual activist. I'm an activist for the soul rather than an activist for something outside of me. I'm an activist for something inside of me that reaches into what's inside of others. So that's what I speak to now. I speak to the soul. Whereas before, I was speaking to the head, which really never goes very far. That was the Coles Notes version of my life. And then earlier this year, I started, well, actually it was late last year, I started having premonitions about ocean collapse that were haunting me in my sleep, in my waking hours. And I couldn't silence them, and I knew that I needed to explore this more, and that prompted some more soul searching. And for me, the best way to heal whatever's inside is to write. So I started writing what I thought was just going to be a journal entry. And then I was guided internally to write this as a blog post. And then it turned into an essay. And really all it was just bearing my soul to this profound reality that it's over. And those were the two words that kept coming up for me with these premonitions. It's over. And my head couldn't really make sense of it, but my heart knew something deeper. And so that was what prompted the essay that has now inspired the conversation that you and I are having right now.
Beautiful sharing of your journey. And I think so many can ride along with that, because I think so many people that are on the early wave of this it's over feeling were activists and have that passion for the planet and that passion for justice and have their eyesights tuned into that and can feel when it's not happening. And then of course climate change comes along in such a big way to feel this ultimate injustice of us destroying our own planet, our own life source. And there's also so many activists feeling a new sense of aliveness or some new reframing of what activism is for them. And that feels like that happened to you as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I still consider myself an activist. Only now I realize that this story that we are living as a species, this collective story of separation, is which I call it, you know, in my work, has played out too long now. And the repercussions of the extended lifespan of this story are now being felt in every aspect of our culture and our civilization and our planet. So we're seeing it from so many different angles now. We're seeing from a cultural perspective, we're seeing extreme disconnect with our technological separation. We see more selfishness, more judgment, more division, more distraction, and on it goes. And then we see, of course, there's biosphere collapse with everything accelerating at rates now where if you look at the news, it's baffling scientists. I mean, for those of us who are aware of what's going on in the world, it's not baffling. It just makes perfect sense. But from a cultural perspective, again, what's happening with the biosphere is shocking. And then you look at what just happened in the US with Donald Trump, and then in the UK with Brexit, with this swing to the far right. I mean, everything is collapsing at an accelerated rate. And it's, like I said, it's just playing out in so many different areas of our human life that it really is over. And so my activism now is more about inspiring the necessity for us to, I mean, I guess this goes back to what I said earlier about I'm an activism for the soul, because even though it's over in the physical plane, doesn't mean that it's over in the non-physical plane. So this is where I get spiritual. You know, with my own spiritual journey, I realize that we are infinite. And so I feel like it's incumbent upon us as in our humanity to live with love and with compassion and with passion and with purpose, regardless of the outcome. You know, it's necessary now to detach, but to still live as fully and with as much life force as we possibly can not because we can save the earth anymore, but just because it's who we are at our core. We are meant to live this way. And so with that sense of urgency, I feel like that's the message that I want to get out now. It was kind of the message that I was getting out before, but because I was still trapped in my own hopium, there was a different angle. It was about creating a better world that is more aligned with our souls. Now it's too late, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't still live as if we are going to have a future, you know, because we do have a future as a soul, not as a species, but as a soul we do.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the reframe for my work now.
Yeah, thank you. And very much along the lines of how it feels for me, and feels so great to feel the reflection and hear the words as they come out of you, because it requires a reframing of our vocabulary. One word that jumped out when you were talking was disconnect. It's like, mm-hmm. We have to disconnect. Well, wait, what am I disconnecting from? I'm disconnecting from this thought that I'm actually a human. Hoping to have some kind of spiritual connection somewhere along the way so that maybe I'll end up going somewhere good later. But to own that I am that infinite life, cleverly disguised as Peter, to some degree lost in this illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's more of a reconnect to who I really am. So we're disconnecting from the illusion.
Exactly. Yes. Right?
And disconnecting has many parts, because we're disconnecting from this idea that status quo was working. We're disconnecting from the idea that politics is working, or that the money system was working, or education. All these things that we've built ourselves to be so wonderful about, we're realizing all at the same time here at an accelerating rate that they're not really working.
Exactly. And that it's not who we are either. None of it is. That's the illusion. All of these cultural systems that we bought into are responsible for disconnecting us, starting with our family system, because our families, our parents, I mean, it's like this intergenerational coma that's been perpetuated for centuries now that's brought us to this point where we're now living in what I finally accepted now as end times. Like, we are living in it. It's not going to happen to another generation. It's not going to happen in 2050 or 2100, which seem to be the magic numbers these days. It's happening now. And I feel like with this knowledge, it's even more important to embrace the sacredness of life and to embrace all of our humanity, all of it, you know, like the grief that comes up, the rage, the anger, the despair, as well as the moments of joy, like pure, unadulterated joy. We need to take all of that in. And we need to wake up to who we are rather than hang on to that old conditioning that has brought us to this collective place that we stand right now. Like, that old conditioning is so damaging. I know that I certainly don't want to go down that way. I want to get rid of as much of this conditioning as I possibly can. And as I do that with myself, have these conversations so that I can inspire that in others too. I had a conversation with Peter Russell, who has been doing work with consciousness for many years, for most of his life. And I'm just going to read this here. He said, an awakening of consciousness is important, whether it's about saving the world or dealing with a world that's falling apart. And for most of my life, I've been doing the saving the world activism thing. And it's been hard. It's been a really hard journey. I have to say that it's been a really liberating paradigm shift that has brought me more peace, more presence, and more passion for this earth without an attachment to an outcome anymore. With this awakening of consciousness that's about dealing with a world that's falling apart. And I think, you know, what there's so many of us who are in that place right now, you know, it's important for all of us to really explore this journey of awakening and explore who we've been conditioned to be and realize that we're not that we're so much more. And, you know, what a beautiful way to go to remember that we are so much more. And in remembering that we're so much more, we are going to be giving more to this earth without attachment to the outcome. Because, I mean, I still go for walks along the lake here where I live, and I see garbage, and I'll pick it up. Not because it's going to make a difference for the earth, but just because I love this earth and I can't not do it. I can't turn a blind eye. So nothing about my love for the earth has changed. As a matter of fact, it's even more pronounced. And that applies to just everything in my life. I mean, that's just one simple little example.
Yeah, but that urgency, that feels like a presence. There's an upgraded presence, if you will.
Yes, yes,
presents itself, what I call sometimes a calm urgency, or what you call the activated presence.
Activated presence, exactly. Yeah, and I really like what you said about calm urgency, because when I use the word urgency, I think that there's this stigma attached to that word about it being chaotic and frantic, but it's not. It's completely the opposite for me. I just feel activated. You know, I feel more activated. It is a sense of urgency, but it's not in a chaotic way. It's in an activated way that makes me, prompts me to no longer sweat the small stuff. Not that I, you know, perfect. I still sometimes sweat the small stuff, but it's less important. There's so many things that I used to place importance on in my life that are so irrelevant now. And that's right. Been liberating too.
Yeah, because you've reframed, you're viewing your life from this different perspective, from the spiritual being having a human experience, from the, I am the infinite. This isn't the end of everything. This is the end of this illusion we've been dancing in. And that it's this activated presence, soul activated presence. My presence is coming from this deep place of knowing, and this soul activated presence, a sap, right? The sap of the tree oozing out, that there's this so much more going on than looks like there's going on.
Yes, exactly. And you know, and it's, I think it's beautiful that you use the sap of a tree as a metaphor, because that is the lifeblood of a tree. That's the lifeblood of our earth. Really, when you think about it, trees and the ocean, the natural world, I mean, SAP is just such a beautiful acronym. You know, you said something about spiritual being having a human experience, and I had a conversation, I think it was last year, with someone on my podcast, and she said something that has really stayed with me. And she said, we are spiritual beings looking for a human awakening. And just that little reframe in the language really hit me in my heart, because it made me realize even more that what we're talking about awakening and the necessity for that, even in these times, you know, end times, that it's even more important. And I don't know why. All I know is that from a soul perspective, with this whole paradigm shift that I've experienced just earlier this year, that I feel like it's even more important for me to awaken to my core essence and to live as much from my essence as possible.
In the background, this car alarm is going off. So I feel this, yes, it is urgent, and it's okay. And I can have a calm urgency about life, but still notice that it brings me to the present moment. And in that present moment to say, wow, this could be the last time I have a Thanksgiving. This could be the last time I see a certain person. And so another thing that's stripping away is the taking for granted of life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I feel like more than ever, moments really matter. It's so interesting because I've always lived a pretty simple and intentional life. And my life has always been guided by my compassion for animals and for the earth. You know, like I've chosen a veganism as a path to really express the essence of my compassion for life, not just for animals, but for the natural world. That just came naturally to me. And I've chosen to be very, very minimalist with my consumption too, because I see the degradation of the earth with all of the mindless consumption out there. But even more now, I find that my life has simplified significantly. You know, we just moved from coastal British Columbia. We've moved inland because of my premonitions that were actually playing out in real time. And in our move, we already didn't have that much stuff in our house, but we got rid of so much. And now we have so much less. And it's so liberating to know that I can live with so little and be even happier. So I have to say that facing the reality of where we're at right now has just been, it's been hard. There's no doubt about it. I'm not going to deny that. And it still is. There are times when I'm out for a walk with my dogs and my partner, and we just are surrounded by so much beauty. But at the same time, there's this knowing that never leaves, which I'm sure you're probably aware of, that knowing never leaves. So it's constantly hanging in my heart to remind me to be more present. But at the same time, I'm just feeling a deeper tenderness for the sacred, which is the natural world, in my opinion. And then also conversations like this, meeting really wonderful people who are like-minded.
Yeah. and feeling that resonance. And again, you said this spiritual beings looking for a human awakening.
You are listening to Sequitur, Freedom from Hope, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart, archived at panina.org.
And as I try to make sense of all of this, that's where it goes is, okay, so if we are spiritual beings, if I am a spiritual being, the infinite time frame exists. And somewhere in that infinity, we created this linear time illusion. And millions of years takes no time, you know, it's just one hour in the afternoon on the porch in the infinite realm. That the deepest yearning in my world anyway is that the humanity might remember, that humanity might awaken to the reality, the ultimate reality, that this really is an illusion of sorts that feels very real, but much like when you wake up in the morning, the dream felt very real. And yet here we are, and that the grandest expression of my humanity is to know myself beyond my humanity.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you know, and before we started recording, you mentioned that you read Conversations with God and how it impacted you. And I also read that book just only a few years ago, and it has completely altered my perspective. I mean, it was huge, hugely influential in bringing me to where I am today. So when you talk about being the grandest version of who you are, you know, I think it's so important. And again, I say this, it's almost like I am repeating myself, but it's regardless of outcome. And I think that that's the thing that is the hardest for us in our humanity is to detach from outcome. I know for me, it was really, really hard because I could not accept the fact that it really was over. And if it wasn't for this internal guidance that was so powerful with these premonitions that forced me really to look at my own version of reality, that I would not have reached this place. I would have clung to any thread of hope that I possibly could because I did not want to believe that it could possibly be over. And now that I have accepted that it's over, the liberation that has come with that is, it's difficult to articulate. But now I realize that non-attachment, which is something that I've read about and I've studied with all of my spiritual quests, it's something that I understood as a concept, but now I understand it on a visceral level, and that's been huge for me too.
Can you really trust that there's a net underneath you, that there is an infinite existence that you are, to where the outcome of this human dance is not the end? I have this hope that this happiness can continue in this form, but when we get enough of these signals that says, wait a minute, the way we're doing it doesn't work for so many species and so much of the earth and so much of everything, that we have to dare to look ourselves in the ultimate mirror and say, wow, you know, oh, was one of the great quotes. We humans, we think we're a good species going somewhere important. And I don't know that we've ever even stopped to say, well, wait a minute, are we a good species? What are we doing as a species? Let alone think that we're going somewhere important, this progress, this more joy, or this more happiness, this more stuff. We think we're a good species going somewhere important.
Well, that brings me right back to my childhood when I already knew that we were not a good species going anywhere important. We were going off the cliff. And that's interesting too, because with this realization, well, not this realization, with this remembrance and this acceptance that I finally reached, I now look back on my childhood and I realize that I have known about this all along. But, you know, it was like a 30-year gap where I couldn't accept it and I needed activism as my outlet. You know, you said something really important there. You said about trusting ourselves, trusting that there's something more, you know, that safety net. And I think that that's so important because we live in a world where we're conditioned to look outside of ourselves for who we are, for our safety, for our identity, for everything. And in that conditioning, we have learned how to loathe ourselves rather than trust ourselves. I mean, self-loathing, self-worth issues abound. It's an epidemic. And learning to trust ourselves, and when I say trusted self, I'm talking about the capitalist self, like the soul self. When we trust ourselves, again, that's a huge paradigm shift too. And it certainly helped me to relax more into my humanity and my life and to realize all of who I am is okay. My grief is as okay as my joy. My anger is as okay as my laughter. All of it is okay because it's all part of the human experience. And in trusting myself and recognizing that all of it is part of the human experience, like, it's helped me expand into more of the whole core essence of who I am. And so that's why the work that I'm doing right now is just so, well, I'm very vulnerable now with my work. It's more open than it's ever been. And it's been liberating for me to be so open, whereas before I was open, but I was still holding a little bit back just for safety purposes. But now I have nothing to lose. I want to share my heart. And in sharing my heart in such an open way, I have touched so many people. It still surprises me. People are begging for permission to be real, to be authentic, and to be able to grieve and to be able to love so passionately. There's a part of me that feels really sad about that. In exposing myself, I have given others permission. Like, we shouldn't need permission because that's who we are. Really, this is what I've wanted to do all of my life with my activism. And now I realize that the simple key has just been like complete vulnerability all along.
And somehow all of this has to make sense in the same game where we're juggling the grief and the gratitude, and we want to live every bit of this that we can, while at the same time we have this knowing that things are shifting.
And fast.
Wow. Yeah. And fast. And that now's the time, and that we're in this little window, this amazing window where the privileged North and this privileged life that I have, where climate change, a lot of these other things really haven't necessarily affected my daily life. I can put the blinders on enough to just go about my daily life, and that we're in this little privileged bubble where we can talk about it, but it's not yet fully activated in my personal world. And so it's a privileged little bubble, I understand, but it is what it is. And all I can do is experience the infinite life through this Peter bubble, this Peter peephole. This is the only way the infinite can see itself, the Peter Melton way, and the Devil's Ark way, and the You Wonderful Listener way. That's your role. Your role is to allow the infinite you to see this warped and filtered human version of the infinite world unfolding in front of us.
Yeah. Again, you brought up a really good point. It's about holding the grief and the gratitude at the same time and navigating the world that way. I have a heaviness in my heart that never goes away. Then when I think about my life, it was always there. It's just a little more prominent now because I don't think that we have much time left. I look at all of the predictions out there, the scientific predictions out there, and I think that they're being very generous. I know that this Earth, that Gaia has a consciousness of her own, and she's like, I'm so fed up with waiting for you guys to wake up that I think it's time to make some radical changes fast because I need to accelerate my own consciousness. So,
all right. Wow. Earth's part of this infinite game. Since you related to the conversations with God, I want to invite you to have a conversation with Gaia and just see what comes out. And just like you just started right there, just let that roll for a little bit. I bet you would have an amazing conversation.
Well, you know, a lot of the essay that I wrote was a conversation with Gaia. It was my heart, which is not separate from Gaia. And so that's when I finally reached acceptance, because I feel like she's been like, oh my God, will you stop with the activism? Will you stop beating your head against a wall? It's over. It's over. It's time for you to shift into a new direction. And that conversation is what came up with the essay that I wrote. You know, last summer, when I was still living on the Sunshine Coast in British Columbia, was really a huge awakening for me, because it was the first time that I'd experienced serious drought. It's the first time that I've lived in a wildfire. So there was wildfire, there was drought. Also, I lived by the ocean, and I saw red tides, like huge red tides, which are really disorienting. They're freaky. It's like somebody has dumped buckets full of bright orange paint on the water, and it's like a slick that doesn't go away. It just expands and expands, and it just takes away all the oxygen, so nothing can live there. And then I was watching starfish withering away and just turning to mush before my eyes. And you know, like, the ocean has always been a huge part of my life, even though my birth home is Ottawa, Canada, so it's pretty landlocked. But my parents were snowbirds. We had a house in Florida, little house in Florida, and my parents would take my sisters and I down to Florida, and we would spend our winters down there. My parents would take us to the ocean after every school day. So my connection to the ocean is really, really deep. It goes back to my childhood. When we were in Ottawa, as a baby, if I was crying, my father would hold me and he would make ocean wave sounds. That was, and it would put me to sleep. So living on the Pacific Ocean and in witnessing all of this death and just the absence of life, the silencing of tidal pools too. I used to love watching the tidal pools and the life that was in them, and just seeing that there's next to nothing now has been really, really hard. So 2015 was pivotal for me with the wildfire and the droughts and actually finally really opening my eyes to how serious ocean changes are. That really shook me a lot. And then the premonitions came after that. So I feel like, you know, having lived it has given me an even deeper connection to the earth and her pain.
Yeah. To attempt to grasp what a miracle it is that we're even here and what a miracle it is that we can communicate to each other is unfathomable. This is amazing and beautiful and terrifying.
It's holding our insignificance and our significance at the same time.
We're trying to be infinite and finite at the same time. It takes me back to just imagining you and I being infinite beings sitting on the porch going, well, what do you want to do with this millisecond? Let's go have a 5 million year experience that we'll call humanity. And then we'll go have some lunch and then we'll figure out what we're going to do, you know, after. and that laugh I call the cosmic chuckle. That's where I like to try to live from. You know, it's not humor. It's this knowing chuckle that while we are destroying our own planet, that this illusion that humanity was everything is being pulled away. The veil is being pulled away. When I am able to tap into the joy of that deep cosmic story that is us unfolding and the illusion that the linear time humanity game is, I just chuckle in the deepest way.
I never thought about it that way, but it is pretty funny, isn't it?
It's hilarious if you can actually put yourself in the infinite world.
I love it.
Yeah. Thank you, Deb, so much. Tell the folks where they can find your stuff and say goodbye to our wonderful listeners.
My website is debozarko.com. So that's DEBOZARKO for American listeners, or OZARKO for Canadian listeners. And that's where I have a podcast, the Unplugged Podcast. It's about unplugging from status quo. And really, I get to have amazing conversations with heart-centered folks who are doing the best they can to navigate these crazy times.
Well, thank you for daring to be vulnerable, daring to share your deep love of the planet and of this crazy journey that we signed up for and created for ourselves and then tricked ourselves into forgetting that we did. What a joy. Thank you, Deb, and look forward to more.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter Melton and Deb Ozarko. And now I want to give Benjamin the Donkey an opportunity to elaborate on the interplay between environmental and social drivers of extinction. You're on, Benji.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's your old pal Benjamin the Donkey. Okay, this poem is a very long set of limericks, so I hope you all stick around till the end. I don't want to look up when it's over and nobody's still here, okay? Okay. The yeast cells. Part 1. The yeast cells realize the food in their petri dish is limited. The yeast cells thought they'd be fine, didn't think that they'd ever decline. But they were just passing through, the way life forms do, till conditions become less benign. The size of the mess on their route made money and politics moot. They could rearrange but not basically change their die-off from overshoot. The cells foresaw analytically that growth would deplete their food critically. They'd still be fine now if only somehow they'd have come to consensus politically. The cells in their dish's debut were a few with lots they could chew, but they could not undo what was true once they grew, though they tried to use bargaining too. The cells faced a grave situation, which led straight to annihilation. Whose fault they were screwed, the dish or the food? or their own lack of determination? Part 2. The yeast cells try to find a way out of their predicament. As doom started getting more mention, it increased political tension. To pick out a fiend, they promptly convened the famous Great Yeast Cell Convention. The cells, they talked wrong and right, and complex beliefs did recite, like about bad and good, as if those things could be useful in fixing their plight. They pushed for depletion prevention and technical hopes for invention. But yeast needs supplies, so to their surprise, their end was beyond comprehension. Politician cells, bribes they pursued, while some paper money accrued. But none of this brawl would matter at all, 'cause none of it got them more food. Those cells, they sure like to eat. To do it, they might even cheat. The urge was so strong, it swept all along. No government form could compete. Part 3. Lack of food leads to warfare for the yeast cells. They liked to find others to blame, although that was morally lame. But plain overshoot was setting their route, and not just some cells they could frame. To eat less, not one would commit. Each cell wanted others to quit. They picked on the lame, upon whom to blame what none was about to admit. The cells thought dish was earth mother, when hungry fought brother v. brother. Despite what was fate, with that danged anger trait, they formed teams and blamed one another. The yeast cells all looked much the same, but when the great food shortage came, they learned to distinguish which ones to extinguish by making them take all the blame. The yeast cells proclaimed right makes might, and being right, they'd win each fight. With slogans they said, bad yeast should be dead, and we are the good guys, right? The cells pitched a terrible fight, as food shortage worsened their plight. They chose up their teams by rightness, it seems, but who can say which one was right? They tried to decide whom to hate and which boogeyman to create. It was hard to decide, but a look from outside showed no one to blame. It was fate. Part 4. The yeast cells finally find acceptance. The cells, it's true they felt pain, but the whole ecologic domain, the dish-wide flat plain, was found to contain indifference when yeast cells complained. They grew in a culture replete with money so they could compete. But with all of that bread, the yeast cells grew dead because it wasn't the kind you could eat. From what did the yeast problem stem? What was wrong inside them to condemn? They played a good game till food shortage became the wrong situation for them. So then, at their life's conclusion, brought on by food source occlusion, they relearned jungle law, and the last thing they saw was through their consensual illusion. The yeast cells, they knew it was late, so they got all depressed and irate. They took bargaining bait, but the plan which worked great was accepting themselves and their fate. Well, that's it for now. Until next time, hee-haw!
Thank you, dear Benji, for that wonderful extended metaphor. I can't leave the topic of freedom from hope without a shout-out to Joanna Macy and the work that reconnects. Her 2012 book, Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy, co-authored by Chris Johnston, is worth a read in this regard. Far from your typical spoon-fed solution to humanity's difficulties, she makes the point beautifully that hope is a quality of character that must be actively cultivated, regardless of outcome, because what we're evaluating is not the situations with which we are confronted, but rather our responses to those situations. At the end of the day, it is only our responses about which we have a choice. The situation is what it is. You know, I always did think they had that serenity prayer thing backwards, that the wisdom to know what can and cannot be changed should come before the courage to change what I can and the serenity to accept what I can't. Well, that's it for now. Thank you, loyal listeners, for your patience in waiting for this show, archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. And special thanks to contributors Benjamin the Donkey for his commentary, John Compost Cossum for his reading of The Dakini Speaks by Jennifer Wellwood, Peter Melton and Deb Ozarko for an intimate and insightful interview, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.